Welcome, everyone, to episode 7. Tonight we have Larry Rippenkroger, who's going to be hosting the show, and you're listening to the history of jet skis. And what we're doing is we're chronicling the first generation stories of the people that kind of made things happen and sort of the legacy that we're still kind of riding that wave today. So, Larry, welcome tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we're stoked. I was so glad that Brenda Burns is like, oh, you've got to get Larry on. I'm like, perfect. So I'm glad she tracked you down. And I don't know, forced you to get in here, but we're really excited to have you on tonight.
Well, I'm excited to reminisce and share what I can remember from back in the day.
Hey, when you first saw the first time you saw a jet ski, do you remember where you were and kind of what the impression was that you got?
Yeah, I was working as a motorcycle mechanic in a Kawasaki dealership up in Sacramento, and our new district manager that was assigned to our region was an enthusiast, and he came in with these wild-looking things, and a lot of the listeners have probably heard the name Bob Ferris, and that's who it was. He was our district manager. And he had one of some of the early prototypes, or early models, I should say. And I was a hardcore motocrosser back then. That's all I wanted to do. I just lived to race motocross. And, but over time, I finally got a chance to go out with Bob, and it was all the same thrills and spills as motocross, but I didn't break any bones every time I crashed. So that was a natural transition for me.
That was kind of the bait or the lure, you know, transitioning from the dirt bike kind of a crowd. And then for me, it was sort of like, wow, the bike's not breaking apart and you can get right back up and you're not going to the ER. So definitely that's kind of, you know, still the benefit for the stand-up crowd. Because back then it was all just the stand-up Kawasaki's. Did you buy one right after that?
You know, they weren't even available to the public when I first rode, and it was like the following year, if I'm not mistaken, the yellow 400s came out. What was that, 76, I want to say? And I believe it was 76, and I think I paid like $1,100 for it, brand new. And, yeah, that was my first one.
So from there, you were in the Central California area, weren't you?
Yeah, I was up in Northern California. I grew up in the Sacramento area in Rio Linda, and lived all around that area, from Rockland, Orangeville, and that general area. But, yeah, I spent a lot of time on the Sacramento River and Folsom Lake and Camp Far West were my stopping grounds back then.
There was quite a really together crowd up in the Sacramento Delta area, really hardcore stand-up riders. I mean, there still is, but that was kind of one of the epicenters. And so was Southern California. There seemed to be like two hubs where there was a lot of mad talent coming out of those regions. And I remember you were known not only as a stand-up racer, but you were really well known for your freestyle. And you had a signature kind of, you had a couple of moves that you did that were kind of considered, you know, the ripper moves. And the most fantastic one of its time was when you would double ride two stand-up jet skis, you know, throttling a right hand, left hand, and straddling one foot in the tray of both of those and then riding around during your trick. Because it was like, can you tell us about those routines? Because they were pretty short routines. You had 2 minutes.
And then it was pretty cool back then too, because you could do both. You could race and do freestyle, and over the years later on it became more specialized where you kind of had to focus on one or the other. But and in fact there was a period of time in competitions where they counted your freestyle points along with your racing close course points for your overall. So you kind of had to if you wanted to try and win an overall championship. But, yeah, the riding two jet skis at once, I'm trying to remember how that even came about. I don't really recall. I think I was just looking for something new and unique and different back then. Another thing that I do remember is the submarine. Learning that absolutely by accident on the Sacramento River, riding with a buddy in the wintertime. The river had flooded and a huge tree had fallen over across a portion of the river. And I'd gotten to where I could bunny hop the jet ski really high. And my buddy challenged me as we came up to this tree. He said, "See if you can hop over that." So I did, and I cleared it the first time. And I couldn't even believe it because it was, I don't know, probably a good 3 feet above the surface of the water at least. And so I circled back around to do it again. And that time I missed and I caught the ride plate on a tree and it sent me nose first into the water and I completely disappeared and it freaked me out. I was underwater and then just let go of the ski and popped back up. And my friend was losing his mind and was like, "Dude, the water was smooth. You were completely gone." And I thought about it. I felt like I was still in control. I think I could have ridden that out if I tried. So then, over the next couple of weeks, I kept bouncing the ski in the air and trying to get the trajectory right and getting thrown over the handlebars numerous times until I finally got it figured out. And the next season, started doing the submarine in competitions. Yeah, it's funny to think that was, considered back then. That was just an amazing move that nobody had ever seen before.
But it really was, because the product that you had to deal with didn't really have the capability of, moving it in those kind of maneuvers. So you really had to put a lot of physical into everything that you did. There wasn't, at that time, there wasn't tow holds and pumps weren't set up differently just for freestyle. So, that was a hard thing. Like you said, you had to go out there and try to refine it. I mean, certainly tricks need to be refined and people practice it, but you don't have the horsepower to help you,
Yeah, very, very true. And I remember one of the first competitions that year and doing a submarine during the competition, and there was a Japanese engineer from Kawasaki that happened to be there. I want to say it was at Long Beach Marine Stadium. And anyway, he came over and was just scratching his head. He couldn't believe it. The thing ran long enough underwater to travel and then pop back up. And he told me in broken English that they were never designed that way. And it should be impossible. It shouldn't run.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Did you ever find at any point during that transitional time where you were creating those tricks, because they were pretty powerful? I mean, people would come to the shore. I mean, everybody was waiting for the freestyle event to kick off. But did you ever have to find a way to ballast the boat or put weight in the front of it or do anything different to try and help you with some of those tricks?
No. The one of the first things I remember was just searching and finding an electric bilge pump and adapting that to it. Initially it was, you do one submarine, then you got to come in and pull the hood off and roll the ski over and dump it out and then go out and try it again. So that was the first accessory in that regard. We did experiment with some lead weights in the front, I remember at one point, but it just didn't seem to do the trick, and we went away from that. The biggest thing that comes to mind, I do remember, I will probably get into this later, but on the movie Waterworld, I had to do this underwater dive to go under the wall of the floating atoll. And we actually put in little scuba tanks to supply the motor with air and then put a whole bunch of lead weight in it so I could travel a long ways underwater. And that's a whole different animal many years later, but that's, in talking about this, that's what that reminded me of.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, because today, all the new personal watercraft come with a lanyard. Back then, if you fell off, the boat would circle around, but you would actually disable that. Didn't you do that in your tricks, or did, if you fell off or lost the boat, not that you did, but would it still circle back around during those programs?
They, if I remember right, we had to turn our idles down all the way to where if you let go, the motor would die. And they actually, if you finished in the top three, you had to, and this was in racing and freestyle, I believe, you had during tech inspection, you had to fire the ski up and then rev it up and then let go of the throttle and the motor had to die. And if it didn't, then you were disqualified.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And then later on, to circumvent the lanyards, guys are putting zip ties over the little push pins for the ignition.
Right. That's right. Yes. Once the lanyards came into play. Yeah.
Dang. Gosh. So you now with the two stand-ups, how did you go about practicing that? Like, what were the learning curves with the two side-by-side skis driving side-by-side? Because that's like, that's worse than water skiing. It's worse than anything. Because you're in control of the thrust and the power.
Yeah. I remember tying two of them together for a while and riding around with both of them tied together, at least in the front, until I felt like I was somewhat under control and was able to keep them fairly close to each other, and then finally untied them. And I don't recall how many attempts it took me before I finally had a successful ride keeping them both together. But yeah, there was definitely a learning curve on that one.
You also used to do the submarine underneath the log jump at the competitions. I remember that. You'd go under the log jump.
And yeah.
Did you ever bottom out or hit any of the anchors on those things?
No, never did, but, oh gosh, I mean, in fact, on one of the world final television shows, I came up a little, I think I went in a little early and popped up too soon, and I actually broke the log jump. There wasn't a metal pipe back then, it was a, 4x4 or some large chunk of wood, and, broke it, and tires, when I went everywhere, and... I remember watching it when it came out, and one of the tires was like right on my shoulder, and it's like, man, I was so freaked out that I'd broken the log jump, I just tried to continue my routine, but I thought, boy, if I'd have really stayed composed, I could have like just dipped my head a little bit and had that tire right on my head and had a little crown as I had a little trophy for that moment, but wasn't to be. But yeah, I know another point, too. I'd ride two jet skis, and I would drop one off and then circle back, and then I started submarining under the second jet ski, and most of the time that went well. But, again, at the World Finals one year, I don't know what was going on. I couldn't do a submarine to save my life that day, and I ended up slamming right into the side of the second jet ski and caused quite a bit of damage to my mechanic's jet ski, if I remember right.
Oh my goodness! Well, you kind of set the tone though for really that respectability of the freestyle routines, because you truly were the one that came on with that professional edge, versus like it's just a prerequisite that you have to do within these disciplines. You kind of attached it to sort of a whole different attitude, and that's something that I remember thinking about you when I would see you at the events, is that you always had the strength of presence out there, like this really was 100% you, and you were going to give everything that you had. It just wasn't one of those, prerequisite or precursory events you had to do.
Yeah, I coming from a motocross background, my dream as a kid was to be a pro motocrosser, like a factory rider, and make a living at it. And I didn't have the means to do that financially. And then when jet skis came along, it clicked so well with me that I kind of had the same dream for jet ski. And it's like, I want to do everything I can to elevate it, so someday you can actually make a living as a pro jet skier, So I approached it that way, but just trying to do the best that I could do and to try to elevate it in any way I could.
Yeah, that's so true. From looking on the outside, versus speaking with you, the impression that I always had was that you were a professional athlete and that you had sort of this grooming about you that wasn't just you're out here having a good time and you're just going with the flow. You're not like a groupie. I mean, you were really trying to make something, you know, I could see in your routines the seriousness and that you were really focused. And I think that impression is sort of a silent mentor for many people. And then when you're that person, when you're Larry Rickenkrager, you may not quite realize that in the moment, but that, you know, that attitude has truly funneled through 3-4 generations to today with these great free ride kids and freestylers that we have today. So you definitely set a footprint for that kind of, you know, attitude that was needed in the sport. And I'd like to thank you for that because I remember watching you at the events and you just kind of stood out. Like you'd look at a NFL athlete, you know, that person carried them kind of a character or dignity. And you brought that to jet ski racing versus, you know, the cool surfer attitude, you know. So you definitely had that, you know, from what you just said and described about yourself, it was very visible. You know, that other people could see that as well. Now,
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so Robert Montgomery was also kind of a big influence for you. He started up the races in Hawaii and brought you over to his series over there. Tell us a little bit about that event, going to Hawaii and racing over there.
Oh, man, that was so fantastic. It was... I think that was the first time I'd ever been to Hawaii. So that was in itself was just, you know, growing up in a small town with very little money and getting a chance just to go to Hawaii and then to be there, you know, on an all expenses trip paid and to be able to race jet skis in the big waves on the North Shore. It was amazing. Competition was fantastic. It was televised on NBC Sports World, and they brought over top riders from all over the world, and they had identically prepared jet skis, and you drew numbers before each heat, and the skis were numbered, so you never knew which ski you were going to ride. And it was every bit as much of a battle of survival just to get around this course out in the monster waves. As much survival as it was competition. I mean, there were some times where you'd get lucky and you'd get through without having to deal with any real big ones, and then there were other times where a wave would come through and either you had to turn around and run or just go for it. And there were times where a wave would just take out the whole pack. I mean, it was crazy, but a tremendous experience. I mean, it was fantastic.
During those days, the top riders were Doug Silverstein, Brian Bendix, and yourself. Was there ever, like, race battles or duels going on at the different events that you guys would participate in?
Doug and I have always been good friends, and I respected him. He was one of the guys when I first got into the sport that I really looked up to. Like him, he and Steve Strickland were the two guys that just – were phenomenal. And I was still trying to figure these jet skis out at this point and had little club races in Northern California. They would come up and race and win everything. And so I've always had tremendous respect for Doug and Brian. We both grew up in the same area in Sacramento. And again, we were friends and we traveled together on tour. But there was a period of time where we were really butting heads and really a real rivalry between us. Now, you know, that all goes away with time as well. We're all good now, but there was a period of time where, you know, we both wanted to beat each other just with a vengeance.
Right. Well, you need that in racing now almost, you know.
Oh,
you
got
to have some kind of hunger to get that podium win.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the first time I'd ever really experienced that. And it actually was good for me when somebody starts bad-mouthing you. And it just makes me personally, it just makes me work that much harder. And just, you know, so you do need that sometimes to really motivate you and take you to that next level.
Right. So the you first started out racing under the USJSBA banner, and then it moved over into the IJSBA. So there was a transitional phase when you were involved, when you would go to a race and you'd complete that event, then you go to the next event. Did you see the growth of the sport, like, right in front of you? And did you kind of know that, that maybe something great was on the horizon with the jet ski platform?
Yeah, it was a really great time to be involved with it, because it started off, like you said, it was a much smaller thing. I think the first year that they technically had a race tour, it was the USJSBA, and there might have only been, I want to say, maybe three events in different spots across the country.
Right.
But it gave everybody just a little taste of what touring would be like. And then the following year, it really started picking up momentum. I think, I don't remember how many races there were, but there was, a couple of months on the road throughout the U.S., and there was actually decent prize money starting to show up. And then somewhere along, I'd have to go back and look through all my scrapbooks and everything, but when the television coverage came with ESPN, that's when things just started to explode.
Yeah, gosh, I remember. And the national tour, when the tour really started to kick off and grow, there was quite a few events, and you did the tour a few years, didn't you?
Yeah, I did it. A lot of years. We'd be gone virtually all summer, just driving from one state to the next. And oh my gosh, that was, I can't tell you how much fun that was. It was, you saw the full gamut. You saw the more professional teams that, and everybody was, but it was a different thing. Even you could be professional, but really have a good time. And everybody was there just to, I mean, you could literally break down at an event and someone from a competing team would give you the parts that you needed to get you back in. And we all helped each other out. That's the camaraderie that there was back then. And it was such a good time. And I think everybody was aware that, certainly aware that the sport was growing really rapidly. And just by the number of rider turnouts and spectator turnouts and the recognition of some of these towns that we go into as we were starting to be on TV quite a bit. So it was a really fun era.
What's one of your most memorable sponsors that you had during those early years of racing?
Certainly in the very beginning was Jetco. They were the Sacramento-based dealership that sponsored myself and a lot of just about everybody else in Northern California, for that matter. One of the very first years I went on tour, I remember I had my own. We rode modifieds and superstocks was in the pro division. And all I had was a modified, so Cliff Jones of Jetco, his wife, he'd built her a superstock. So that became my superstock for the summer. He loaned me his wife's jet ski. So that was what I took on tour with me.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, oh, boy. I'm sure that there was a lot of stories out of that.
I'm sure we could do a whole episode on just that whole. Yeah.
They say some stories shouldn't be told, though, but you know.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly quite a few things that come up to mind, when I look back just from, my perspective, looking back and seeing some of the fun antics that went on. I mean, today, if he did that stuff, he'd be in jail, but back then you can't do those fun things anymore. They're considered, dangerous, not safe, can't have not fun,
It was definitely a whole different time back then, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think that our kids' generation are ever going to experience something like that. Never.
No.
I remember one time I was at one of the tour races. I think we were in Chicago, and I got up early in the morning and I saw one of the racers going by on a moped, you know, just having a good time doing wheelies and whatever else they wanted to do and zigzagging around. But they were towing a competitor's helmet that was on fire that they had snagged. I mean, that's one of the safe stories, right?
Yeah.
And I know that because that competitor's trailer was in my enclosed trailer. So I'm like, how the hell did he get that, you know?
Right, yeah. Oh, there were so many. Yeah, I mean, it's fun to get together with some of the gang from back then, because I've forgotten a lot, but as we start bouncing stories off each other, it all starts coming back. And yeah, sometimes it's amazing that any of us survived back then with some of the crazy, stupid things that we did. Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's hard not to name people.
Yeah. I mean, we this came up just in Lake Havasu for the World Finals in October. Steve Strickland was there, and we started reminiscing a little bit, and the story came up where all the traveling pros, we all basically ran out of town. We got escorted, a police escort, out of Black Hills, South Dakota. We got kicked out of town up where Mount Rushmore is. The official charge was defrauding an innkeeper, because I think there was like 14 of us in a hotel room with sleeping bags trying to save money, you know. But there was a lot more to it than just that. But we'll just leave it at that.
I remember one time coming out in Florida in the morning and seeing another competitor's jet ski 30 feet up in a tree. And yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. I had nothing but fond memories of it. It was such a great, great era. And you know, the other thing I really enjoyed about the sport back then too was every year the skis got faster and faster and more accessories and all that. But anybody that had good mechanical knowledge, I mean, we saw a lot of guys from just podunk towns all across the country that would show up with really fast jet skis. You could build them in your garage, and a lot of guys were very competitive without having a fortune behind them. Just, you know, if they were good mechanics and had the time to experiment a bit, you never knew what you were going to run into. So
you eventually ended up riding for Performance Jet Ski, right?
Yeah.
They were kind of considered the pinnacle. You know, if you could get a ride with PJS, you were kind of like one of the untouchables in our sport. It was a rare occurrence.
Yeah. I switched to PJS in going into 1984. And, that was phenomenal. In fact, that year on tour, I was undefeated in the pro modified class. It was an amazing year. The skis were, back then, that's, like you said, those were the untouchable skis. The two blue boats that I had were like the factory race team boats. And then he had the stuff he would sell to the public. But what I was riding was the secret stuff that was all built in the secret R&D test room. And that was pretty darn cool to be a part of that. And then it continued to advance from there. I mean, each year it just got faster and better and more sponsors involved.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. The national tour would take riders all around the country, and that was sort of a several-month blockout. And then the pinnacle of that would be to earn points to go to World Finals. And then World Finals was the big show. And the only thing that's left of that is some old VHS videos and photos. But we don't have anything like that today in the United States in physical form. So tell us a little bit about what those days were like at the World Finals at the Nautical Inn.
Oh, man. I mean, that was definitely the heyday of the sport. I mean, I don't know if any of the listeners have seen like overhead pictures of the Nautical Inn where they had massive grandstands up. And I think some of the numbers that I've seen as far as spectator turnout was something like 20 or 30,000 spectators or something ridiculous like that. I mean, we outgrew that venue. It was just amazing. For me personally, it was a dream come true because all my childhood dreams of becoming a pro motocross or a factory rider and everything, suddenly it was really there. It was really happening, just in a different sport. And riders from, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of riders from all over the world. Just massive, massive turnout. And all the pressure and everything that goes along with that, suddenly the fun sport, suddenly you're at that event, all of a sudden you feel like, wow, this is big all of a sudden. This is a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it went from, you know, two-place jet ski trailers to enclosed trailers to semi-trucks and box fans. It just blew up. So it was no longer the hobby sport.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You were one of the fortunate ones who earned your placing in the kind of elite arena, to where, you know, you had the full package. So you had the name, you had the capability, you had a couple titles already, and you had the stamp of the best company supporting you. So we equated men and women like you on that level as our rock stars of our sport. And certainly it had that kind of vibe. But don't you think back in the mid to late 80s, though, that the energy was so much more pure in terms of people really wanting to have fun in gatherings? It seems to be a little more distracted with the social media thing today. It's not quite the same energy, although it's still kind of alive. But back then it was more personal, I guess.
Yeah, there was definitely a different vibe to it. It was, I'm trying to find the right words for it. It was just, it was hip and it was cool. And it was like people would come from all over the world just to be a part of it, just to witness it. I know I'm struggling to find the right words to describe just the feel of it back then.
It was, I mean, super, it was just high energy.
Yeah.
It was really high.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to go to sleep. And it was party all night, race all day, and it went on for a week. And it just,
right.
Really a hard attitude to describe, but it was really something new and different and unique. And it had kind of been the newest motorsport available to this younger generation. You know, we had motocross, but now we had something on water that was very equivalent in terms of the style and the type of people involved. So it was cool.
Yeah. I think you hit it there. It was a new motorsport, and it was really cool. I mean, what sticks out in my mind as you said that is just how many people, famous people, stars from other sports, were involved. I mean, factory pro motocross riders were racing jet skis too, and NASCAR drivers would show up to watch the event. And just, I mean, it was just the coolest vibe back then.
Yeah, I know. It's so sad when we say, "Oh, the memories," but it makes me feel really old. But it still has that enthusiasm that you can see in this new generation. And I really, truly appreciate the free ride and the stand-up community racers, because they're really trying, I think, to reconnect to what we experienced. And they get it. You know what I mean? Like, they understand it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm seeing that too. And it's great to see, 'cause after the decline in the sport was just, by then I was out of it, but at the same time it was hard to just hear about it and see it. And I still try to make the world finals every year, and it was just sad to see, you know, from what it was to what it had reduced down to. But it, over the last number of years, there seems to be a resurgence and a new growth happening, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, there's because Kawasaki is no longer making the jet ski stand up, but there's a huge hunt right now to find all the old vintage boats and get them running again. And like there's a guy, a friend of mine tomorrow, he's got a bunch of older skis that he has meticulously reconditioned, and they're beautiful. I mean, they're showroom beautiful. And there's like all these things that you see with riders is that they're trying to get and find out where these boats are, you know, who's got one in the barn, you know, that find to get.
Right.
Do you still
right.
have any of your old stand-ups?
I do. I managed to, and I've been asked this a lot, like, you know, what happened to all my race skis, and I wish that I had hung on to just one of them, and I didn't. Reason being that at the end of the season, we would always sell them for, they were worth so much, like to the Japanese back then, is where most of them ended up. We got top dollar for them at the end of the season, then you would just build a new boat for the following year. But, you know, I don't know how many years ago it was, I was really hungry to get a hold of one of my old skis and was starting to put the word out there, and gosh, I'll remember the name tomorrow, but right now it escapes me.
Sure.
Somebody called me or emailed me and said, hey, one of your old skis is on Craigslist down in Florida right now. So
cool.
He sent me the link, and I, you know what? I want to say, it might have been, I think it was Gary Hart, the more I think about it.
No kidding.
And, yeah, and he said, one of your old skis is on Craigslist down in Florida. If you don't buy it, I'm going to buy it. And so I clicked on the link and called the guy up, and come to find out, it was the same owner that I had sold it to way back when, and it was still in great shape. It had been on display in his shop for forever. And the motor was trashed and everything. But anyway, long story short, I do have, it's one of my old freestyle skis, and I've rebuilt the motor and everything. I still haven't ridden it. It's put together and fired it up, and then it's been on display in my garage. But now with having a place in Havasu, I'm sure I'll be breaking that out next spring, running it around Body Beach a bit.
You're going to be the king of Body Beach. You're going to have to part out of your wake, stay out of your way.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my God, that's so cool.
Yeah,
it's going to be great to have you back in Havasu. That'll be awesome. What do they call that? The jet ski capital of the world?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I always thought I'd probably get a place in Havasu someday, and then I don't even really know how it came about. Just been spending more and more time here, and thought, you know what? I'm starting to think about retirement down the years, and where do I want to end up and everything. And
right.
So we got a place here in Havasu, and going to start spending a lot more time here, and not going to retire anytime soon, but at least when I'm not working, I'll be on the water.
Yeah, don't ever retire. Don't do that.
No. I love my job way too much right now.
Don't use that
think
word.
About it.
That's a taboo banned word.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think so. So you got 4 world championship titles that you earned, and then you started to transition into the movie industry. What was the catalyst, and how did that take place in your life to get you into the film industry?
I wanted to get in for quite some time and had a couple of false starts. There was at one point in time, Canon Pictures, which back in the 80s, they did all these Chuck Norris and Jean-Claude Van Damme movies and everything. They decided they were going to do a jet ski movie, and they contacted me and wanted me to star in it. So I was all excited. And I could write a book on just the whole roller coaster ride of getting in. But anyway, that fell through, and I was trying really hard to find a way to break into the business, and it was just the old being at the right place, the right time, with the right skills. Going into 1994, I got a phone call that changed my life. It was the stunt coordinator for the movie Waterworld. And actually, Bob Montgomery had already met him, and they were going to get his power skis in the movie. And the stunt coordinator, R.A. Rondell was his name, he asked Bob if he knew like a pro jet skier that could do some jet ski stunts in the movie, because none of the stuntmen in Hollywood could do it. And Bob recommended me. And then another buddy who was happened to be doing special effects on the movie gave him my name as well. So next thing you know, I got the phone call, and found myself a short time later in Hawaii, just in a daze, walking around looking at this floating city. I was pinching myself, like, is this really happening? I'm really here. I'm really doing this, you know. And to this day, still, now that I've been in the business 21 years, that was the best movie making experience of my life. It was nearly 8 months in Hawaii, getting paid to ride jet skis and learn how to do fire burns and shoot machine guns and all that crazy fun stuff.
Oh, that's fantastic. That was truly a pivotal movie, too, in film and cinema, because Kevin Costner, who also produced his own movie, really tried to do something different and powerful. He paid a high price for it, but he really did come up with, you know, a vision that translated it through action. And anything on the water is horrendous to deal with because it's not a fixed environment.
Yes. Yeah. I was told I would be needed for like 10 weeks initially. And then, like I say, it was nearly 8 months is what it ended up being, just because it took so long to shoot these sequences and script changes. And as you mentioned, just a changing environment. There were a number of days where the wind would change and everything that they'd prepared for that morning was out the window. And but still, it was a life-changing experience for me.
And really great, because you truly fit that work. I mean, I can't really see you doing anything. I can't see you being a mechanic today. I can't see you doing, you know, anything other than, you know, like you found your right fit in life. So,
yeah.
You know, hats off to Montgomery for opening up that door for you and allowing you to put your passion into your work.
Yeah, I completely agree. I couldn't see myself working in an office anywhere. I've been blessed. I've been very fortunate. It was a dream come true. And then it wasn't easy. You know, I remember when that movie ended, it was kind of bittersweet. And I was hired by Universal Studios to help put together the Waterworld live show down in L.A. But it was a full year or more before I got my next movie job, because, you know, I was pigeonholed as a jet skier. And then the next movie was Waterwork again. But then slowly over time, and training with all the stuntmen that I met on Waterworld, learning how to do all these other things, you start getting little opportunities here and there, but there it is. It's a battle. It's a struggle to get out of that little niche that you get pigeonholed in.
Right. And the jet ski was sort of your pathway, and then you had to excel in other mediums. Yeah. Well, that's the difference, though, with, you know, to be very blunt, with greatness and mediocrity. Mediocrity will sort of stew, you know, an individual who might have a dream, they might have the passion, but they're not willing to do the hard work and persevere through those really rough patches.
Right.
There is a difference
yeah.
in character that creates the greatness in a human being. And you always had that drive, and that showed through competition, you know, the competitive mindset.
Yeah, you know, I'm, yeah, I, I'm trying to remember where I heard this, because I can't take credit for it, but it was an interview with someone, an athlete who had excelled in their sport, and they asked, you know, what their secret was, and he said, I just work harder than anybody else, and I adopted that. You know what, that's me. And I just, in Sacramento in the early days of jet skiing, in the middle of the winter, with a dry suit on and a bonfire on the beach, out there riding with just, you know, steam pouring out of the exhaust because it's so cold out. But I just kept telling myself, somebody else is out there practicing today. I've got to be here too. I've got to work hard, you know. And that wasn't any grand secret. It's just try to work harder than anybody else.
You know, the other thing, the other aspect of your career is the duality of intent, because while you've been seeking your own path, there's been two generations behind you following your path and also making a career path in similar areas that you are. I know a good friend of mine, Mark Gomez, you know, what certainly wasn't one of the first generation riders after you at Universal Studios to work in the Waterworld show, but he definitely took that on, you know, and he's kind of one of those great, talented people that are very driven, have great vision, an extremely talented athlete. He's intelligent. He's a total package. So like he's the shadow of you. And there's other men like that. Chris Gann too is another man that comes to my mind. And there's other people in that arena that have the same aspiration that you do. And like you said, they're gonna have to work very hard and, you know, map that out. But, you know, thank you for opening that, because somebody always has to cut that path first, you know, and it's usually a lot more painful.
Yeah.
I think they call it sacrifice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Like Chris Gann now has a really successful career in the film industry. He's doing great. Another one, Clay Cullen from back in the, probably the, I guess Clay would be maybe considered a second generation era rider, but he's doing great.
That's right.
And then, yeah, as you mentioned, Mark Gomez and, oh my gosh, there's a handful of guys now that are doing really well.
They are. And they're very disciplined and polished and extremely talented. And the great thing is to get to use new technology.
Yeah.
And if they didn't have that technology, they're the same individuals that are creating it. You know, like Blosian's come up with all these great parts and accessories to help these guys become more improved and get the advantage to, you know, the sky's the limit. And the Japanese, I can't even name all the guys, but all the top running freestyle and freeride guys in the world right now are pushing that sport to levels that we can't really comprehend what their footprint's going to do 10 years out from now. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's hard to even imagine where it's going to be years down the road with what they're doing now. It's amazing.
I saw on your Facebook page today you had posted up this group that was skydiving with a stand-up jet ski, which is friggin' hilarious. And you had made a comment and you said, oh, they get more air, you know. Guys get more than anybody, and you know, it's crazy to see, like, because of our age, you know, pushing past the 50 year mark, you know, half a decade, a decade from the 70s, and then the next decade in the 80s, and then the 90s, and so moving these generations forward in 10 year blocks or increments, you can just see, like, looking back, turning back the clock, how invasive the stand-up jet ski image is throughout society, throughout culture, throughout the world. I mean, it's everywhere now. Children's toys, it just, sky's the limit with it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
And you got to be one of those founding first-generation riders, because there was a big movement. There wasn't a lot of jet skis being sold in the 70s, but it was blowing up quickly. I mean, it wasn't like there was 25,000 of them being sold a year like there was in the mid-90s, you know, or 75,000. So the footprint was very small, but the community was very, very tight. And everybody threw in their energy and their vibe created that influence in society. So it really was a revolutionary type of a vessel in a lot of ways. And for you, you know, when you look at not only your lifestyle, but your career path, that career path coincided also, like when you hit the mid-1990s, then you transitioned into another platform using that jet ski, you know, talent that you'd, you know, invested so heavily in, and then made a second career. And you know, that's a pretty fantastic thing to see, because there are very few people who are able to really make careers off of the jet ski platform. I mean, true careers. And you were
right.
One of them that broke through. So
mm-hmm.
pretty wild.
It is. It is. It's, I mean, I've had several dreams come true through, you know, childhood dreams and then secondary dreams of breaking into the film industry and having the jet ski open the door to that. It's amazing. And it's been a great ride, I'll say that. I unquestionably wouldn't be here without, you know, the whole jet ski career prior to this. There's just no way I could have broke in and gotten to where I am now. There's just impossible. No way.
Everybody in their lifetime can say that there was certain individuals at different times in their life that really inspired them or motivated them. When you were in the jet ski scene, was there anybody that you really looked up to and admired, or somebody in another sport that you really had sort of kind of like, yeah, I get that person. I'd like to follow that kind of a attitude. Did you have anybody like that in your life?
Well, in the very beginning, I think I mentioned like Doug Silverstein and Steve Strickland, those guys, and their jet ski abilities when I first got in. They were the ones I looked up to. And then as I progressed and started winning, I still enjoyed motorcycles, and the one guy that really sticks out is he was a factory rider, Ricky Johnson. He got into jet skis, and I met him through PJS. He was getting his skis done there and everything. So Ricky and I actually became good friends and hung out together, went jet skiing together a number of times, and it was cool. Just watching him at motocross races and see how he handles himself and how he just the way he approached everything was really inspirational to me. And it's pretty darn cool when you have heroes or people that you really look up to, and then you meet them and they don't let you down. They're everything you thought they would be, and just an added bonus when you actually get to, you know, befriend them and hang out with them on a personal level as well.
Did you ever cognitively realize or think that maybe you also were being, you know, a mentor, inspiring somebody that never really reached out to you but was watching you at the races? Did it ever kind of get to you that, hey, my behavior here might be helping somebody else? Did that ever hit you when you were in the jet ski scene?
Yeah, you know, I've told this story a couple of times. When I was a young kid racing motocross, the very first time I went to like a big pro race, and it was Hangtown, the big event that comes to Sacramento every year. And I won't say who it is. I don't want to badmouth anybody on here, but I went up and asked for an autograph. I was a young guy, but I asked for an autograph from one of the factory riders that I really, really looked up to. And this guy totally blew me off. And I was crushed, you know, and I was like,
right.
One of those little moments in life where I just, to myself, I went, you know what, if I'm ever someone that somebody asked me for my autograph, I will never treat them that way. You know, and so I've never forgotten that. And, you know, I won't say that, you know, I haven't one guy, I remember, I won't even get it, but you know, everybody has good days and bad days, but I'd like to say I've never treated anybody that poorly. You just try to treat everybody as you would like to be treated. And you know, you get a lot of, I've had a lot of parents come up to me and tell me exactly what you were saying, that, you know, my kid watches your videos over and over and over, and he just, he wants to ride like you someday, and on and on. So yeah, you get taste of that throughout your career. I am, for the most part, you know, I just trying to do my thing, and thought that, you know, if I'm inspiring somebody or helping somebody along the way, then that's just an added bonus or benefit as well.
You know, it's interesting. My friend Mike DeMauro yesterday was telling me that a lot of the kids are, you know, call them kids, they're adults, but due to my age, they're kids. They are watching and studying the freestyle maneuvers from back in the 80s, and they're getting a deeper, more profound appreciation for what you guys were doing. So, you know, that effect is not going to go away because, you know, the technology is so much more significant, or the talent's different, or the sport has emerged in a different way. I mean, people are going back to the roots. And have you seen that movie? Oh, God, what's the name of it? It's an F1 movie. It was a really great documentary. Oh, I probably don't have it right. But they went back and revisited the founding racers of the sport and the transition from the unsafe riding to the safe riding. And the documentary was not only a timestamp of that sport, but it's so relevant today. I mean, a lot of that hasn't really changed. So all those old VHS tapes that are rotting away and are not on DVD anymore, you know, they're, if you look at YouTube, the hits on them are pretty high. So the visitation, there's a lot of people going back and they're studying for little things. They're looking for that one thing different, you know, that they might be able to revitalize or incorporate into something today. And that's pretty cool if you think about it, you know, that
it's
legacy, it's still going on, man.
yeah. I ran into somebody recently, and it was a father, and he was telling me about his son that watches Jet Dreams, I think he said it was, like literally almost every day. And then especially on weekends if they're getting ready to go jet skiing, he'll watch Jet Dreams before they go ride because he wants to try to do it. And that's one of the cool things about that era is, you know, if you get a vintage ski from that time, I think just about anybody can learn to do what we were doing back then. It's not unobtainable by any means. So it's pretty cool that all lives on.
It's neat. Yeah, it's great. So the movie industry, what has been your favorite movie to work on where you really, you know, either you were challenged enough to where you went to a higher level of your capability, or that just the vibe of the set was really cool, or the environment? Is there one film or television show that's like a pinnacle for you?
First thing that comes to mind is the most recent Die Hard 5, and I think the core reason for that is the previous Die Hard on the fourth one is where I got hurt and almost died. And well, for those that don't know, I fell off of a fire escape, I don't know, 25 to 27 feet head first, right to the street, and had compound fractures of both wrists and smashed my face and ribs and all kinds of things, and that laid me up for about a year and a half. And that was the lowest in my life, I can say for sure. It was, I don't know, multiple surgeries and physical therapy, and then more surgeries, more physical therapy, and you know, hearing things and, you know, rumors in the industry that, you know, career ending injuries and all these things, not knowing if I'd ever be able to work again and so on and so forth. And having to just reach down and fight to get healthy again and to get back into shape and recover from all this to approximately 5 years later to go back and double Bruce again on that latest Die Hard. And absolutely just was so driven to just knock it out of the park on that one, and did. And they ended up winning a Taurus Award for the driving sequence that I did. And that Taurus Award is the equivalent in the Sun industry is our highest awards, like our Academy Award. So, yeah, just the vibe of being back on another Die Hard movie and just the determination to just kill it, you know, and do it and then get rewarded for it later. That's what really sticks out.
It's going to sound a little off the wall, but just listening to you with your description, it reminds me kind of like a spiritual side saying that, like, you needed this to become even greater. I mean, I know it sounds kind of weird, but it sounds like your game or your skill sets are now on a whole higher level, that your capability got redefined after that injury. It didn't change you for the worse. It enhanced you for the better.
In many ways, it did. Yeah, yeah. I on so many levels. Just that, I don't know. Sometimes the challenges that get thrown your way in life can knock you down a couple of levels, and you don't ever get all the way back up. And other times, I mean, in this case, it was my driving is probably the main thing. I just spent so much time practicing and some stunt driving schools and racing schools and everything, just trying to take it to that next level. And you know, it's rewarding to work that hard and have it pay off, you know.
Well, it seems to me that there's this common theme throughout your dialogue tonight, and that's about how much dedication and time you invest in everything that you're pursuing. And I think for the viewers or the listeners, it's so important to grasp what that means in forward motion in life, because things just didn't come to you. You've really worked hard, and you've had the struggle, life-threatening injuries, overcome them, and actually in a very short amount of time, for the type of injuries you had, you're back probably stronger for it and probably more tuned into what you're doing, more precise, I would imagine. I would think so,
yeah.
Because you healed so fast.
Yeah, you know what, you're touching on it. It's like, I definitely feel like I'm a lot more in tune with just life in general. I mean, I've always been thankful for what's come my way, but after surviving that accident, I mean, every single day now, it's just a blessing just to be alive and, you know, a new level of appreciation for everything, I guess. Put you more in tune. Don't want to get too spiritual on everybody here, but it's hard to find the right words for it, but I think you know what I'm saying, where you just more in tune with everything.
Yeah, right. I get it. I totally get it. So you've had a lot of nominations for Screen Actor Guild Awards as well. I went on your profile, your MDB, I think it is.
Oh,
I might have that wrong.
Yeah.
IMDB, uh-huh. Yeah. I went on there to kind of look up, you know, what movies in the history, that path line that you have. It's pretty formidable. I mean, in 20-something years, I mean, you've amassed work in 75 different film platforms over that, and, you know, film and television. And these are all really cool movies. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't
yeah,
really
I've been
realize.
I've been
yeah, I didn't
very
realize
fortunate.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I really am impressed. Didn't know that, you know, these are some of the movies that I go to. Some of them are just pretty phenomenal. Abraham Lincoln, The Vampire Hunter, I thought that was a cool movie.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, When I saw the Russians for another movie, I'm like, oh, I didn't know you were in that. That's pretty good. Iron Man 2, pretty damn. G.I. Joe, oh, my God. There's so much like your personality. It's hilarious. Action man, you know.
Yeah, it's been great. I've been fortunate. I got involved with a great group of guys there in Hollywood. There's these stunt groups that are like a fraternity is kind of the best way to describe them. And there's like four different major stunt groups in town. And it's really tough to get in one. It's kind of like for the upper echelon of the stunt industry. And I was lucky enough to get invited into a particular group. And I'm a member of Brand X is the name of the group. And with that, then you a lot of times you're working on the top movies. Last year I did one I'm really looking forward to seeing. It's Batman versus Superman. Comes out, I think that comes out around Christmas or so. But it's been pretty darn cool. One of the better experiences that sticks out in my mind too is I doubled Bryan Cranston on the Breaking Bad series, and that was amazing because the writing on that show was so good. And I told Bryan this. Of all the people I've ever doubled, I've never gotten chills watching scenes being shot until that show, because he is such an amazing actor and off camera, one of the funniest guys I've ever been around. But to see that show, where they were taking it. And then the toughest part was when we shot the ending of it. I couldn't say a thing to anybody for like 6 months until it aired, but I knew how it all ended and I had to bite my tongue and keep that in.
That's hard, yeah. But that part of the professionalism, you know, pride of work has to be kind of parked for a while.
Yeah.
It's funny. I have my family has a line in my family that's been in Hollywood for a couple of generations, and my uncle Warren Ray did a lot of sound, and I was looking up and comparing to see if he had worked on any of the movies he had worked on, but unfortunately, no. Dang it. I was like, oh, come on. Yeah. Oh, well. But yeah, you've got quite a pedigree going here. And your list of stunt capability is really phenomenal. You've got jet skiing, driving, which is vehicle driving, motorcycles. What's this fire? What does fire mean? That you can be doused in flammables and lit on fire? Is that what that means?
Yeah, fire burns. And I just got back. I was working in Boston on a Ben Affleck movie for all this month. Just I got back home Wednesday, just before Thanksgiving, and doing a car chase there, crashed some cars, and then I hadn't done a fire burn in a while, but I got to do one on that show again. So, yeah, that's another one where your brain is just going, what are you doing? You know, you just... Sometimes there's these inner battles that go on inside your head. You're questioning your sanity sometimes. Yeah.
Good, bad. Of course you went the bad.
Yeah.
I was involved in a car fire one time, and it's like, yeah, that's hot. It's called like melting your skin, you know. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Anybody wants to be around. What is an air rams? What's air rams?
Air ram is, you don't see them used so much anymore, but it's a, how do I describe it? It's like a catapult, miniature catapult. It's a little platform you run up to, and when you step on it, it's got an electronic button that senses your pressure, and it has a pressurized cylinder in it, and they can adjust the amount of pressure in it, and basically... catapults into the air. So you see them a lot when guys are running along and then an explosion goes off and the guy goes flying through the air from the explosion. It's usually an air ram on the ground that throws him into the air.
A part of me is kind of laughing and going, okay, that's how that's called ouch. that's called hurt. What is a ratchet?
Sometimes.
What's ratchets? On your list, it says ratchets.
Yeah, ratchets are used a lot more in common now than air rams. And ratchet is simply underneath your wardrobe. You have a jerk vest on, and it's worn real tight. And then there's loops in the various pick points, we call them, and they hook a cable to you, and the other end of the cable goes through a couple of pulleys and then down through this thing called a ratchet, and it's just a big hydraulic ram, basically, and they pressurize it and yank you into the air, or yank you across the room and slam you into a wall or something, and then they digitally erase the cable so it looks like you've been thrown by whatever means, whether you've gotten shot or whether an explosion has sent you through the air or that sort of
Do you have a professional masseuse? Like, I'm hurting listening to
thing.
this.
Yeah, I
Oh,
mean, I'm sure. There's some mornings where you wake up and it's, you're aching all over the place, and other days you're on set and you're just an overpaid extra, where it's like I can't believe I'm getting paid to sit here and not do much of anything. So I guess it all
yeah.
balances out in time.
So your list of specialties, it continues. It says that one of your capabilities is fights. You have rappelling, climbing, water skiing, snow skiing, boat driving, mountain biking, and rigging. Rigging is the last on your list. What is rigging?
Rigging is setting up a lot of these stunts, whether you're just something as simple as an actor has to be just suspended in the air a little bit. So you might be on set rigging them with a line from their vest up to a support or a structure. Or it can be very complicated in some cases where it's a ratchet for a stuntman, that sort of thing, where you're setting that up. And so it's just learning. Oh, well, a lot of knots, a lot of knot tying, learning various knots, and oh, I don't know, a little bit of engineering with some of the equipment and how things work.
Cool. On your list on the internet, it says that in 2016 you've got several movies that'll be coming out, and it looks like some of them are completed, some are in post-production, and it's already got you fired up to the year 2017 with an event coming up too for film. That's quite a great lineup right there. I mean, you're staying busy.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate to keep working, and I'm getting to the point where I'm doing more stunt coordinating and a little less of the actual stunts, which is kind of nice because you get to make those phone calls and hire guys and then have them hit the ground and have them be sore the next day instead of
Yeah.
yourself.
Oh, that's great. Because you've got this long list of pedigree of, and every single one of these movies has a different stamp to it according to what the physical requirement was for that stunt. So the diversity of your knowledge, and also with the technology changing, and getting better, as stunts getting safer means that they're actually going to get riskier too, I imagine. Is that true?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon with the computer-generated thing, CG stuff. That when that really came on the scene, a lot of the stunt industry was like, "Oh boy, that marks the end of our careers." They're going to start replacing everything with CG, and that hasn't been the case at all. If anything, that's used to enhance what we do and makes things safer for us. As an example, like when I first got in the business, high falls were still pretty prevalent, and if you had to jump off a building, you'd put the airbag down below, and you would actually do the fall and trust the bag to land. You'd have to land properly and trust the bag to stop you, and that is almost non-existent now. It's almost all done with cables and. They can digitally remove the cables so inextensively now that it makes our job a lot safer because you're hooked to a cable. You're not free falling, even though it looks like it. They can slow you down and stop you at the bottom, plenty safe. And then fire burns too. You don't have to do these massive burns where you're just totally engulfed in flames. You can do it at a level that's safer, and then they just digitally add some more flames to it to make it look a lot more dangerous than what it was. So, yeah, it's with the technology and the increased technology, I'd say it's made things safer.
Wow. It's a different, you know, when we were growing up, stunts and the film industry was so different because you didn't have, what is it, green screen, they call it. You had, everything had to be done in the moment. There was no digitizing or adding in or extracting the different types of effects that they would have to use in film added in would be totally different from today. That interface has really sped up. But what I've seen is that there's more action in movies now than ever before because of that. It wasn't like that, you know, in the 80s. It was a slower draw into it, and now it's just like it's humping the whole time during the movie. So it's like an energy fest, you know, like, whoa, and now what? Look at this. And, oh, my God, you know, the capability has given so many tools.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. A lot of the stuff that we shoot in front of a green screen, how realistic they can make it look. I mean, there was a time where you could always tell, and you still can to a degree. And audiences, that's what we are told all the time, is audiences can tell, and they want the real deal. They want a real car chase. They want real explosions and that sort of thing, which is great for us. But it's getting better. Nothing worse. In fact, my wife hates it if we're in a movie theater and there's something that comes up and it looks really phony, because I'll actually groan in the theater just like really loud. And it's like, and I get the old elbow inside, you know. So, you know, it's got to look real. That's the thing. And, but it's getting better.
Have you been back to Universal Studios anytime lately to see the shows going on that you actually had a footprint in originally?
Yeah. Let's see. Probably at least once a year, I'd say, we get back. And it's pretty cool. For the longest time, I think it's finally changed last year, but for the longest time, it was still my voice on the soundtrack when for all the stuff that isn't live mic'd, that's actually recorded, when Helen comes into the arena and the atoll are up on the wall, yells, "Helen, it's good to see you alive." I can't believe I still remember this dialogue, actually. And then my voice for the longest time. But now saw the show last year, and it's actually even better than what it was. They've got some new management running the show, which actually is some buddies that I used to work with there, and now they've got a company that manages these live shows. And they've added a few more characters, and they've live mic'd most all of them, and that's really good now.
Yeah, it's a whole different beast. So have you earned a new nickname in the stunt world?
It's ironic that you are asking this, because I'm going to tell you a story that's pretty good. I've always been Ripper, even in the stunt world.
Yeah.
Until last week, on this movie, we were driving these vintage cars from like 1927 era Model A's, Model T's, and they had a number of them that were modified with big V8 motors and everything, but you still had the real narrow wheelbase, and they're much taller than they are wide, and then 4-inch wide little tires. But yet they wanted us doing a car chase and just hauling butt in these things and sliding corners. And on one of the 180s that I was throwing, I was dirt tracking one of them in this parking lot, and I caught a pothole with one of the rear tires and put the car, just tipped it over on the side really quick, just slammed down on the driver's side. And it's funny, because over the years now, that would have probably really freaked me out in the early days. Now I'm just wham, I'm on my side and my shoulder is in the dirt, and I'm like, wow, that was quick. And I just, the motor still runs. I just calmly reached up and turned the ignition off. the passenger was kind of freaking out, and he was climbing out and stepping all over me trying to get out the passenger window. Anyway, the stunt guys later that day started calling me Larry Flippin' Kroger instead of Rippin' Kroger. And Tippin' Kroger and Flippin' Kroger became the call sign on that show. But that's not going to stick.
I see some engraved barware in your future.
Yeah. So that was one show nickname. Hopefully, I won't be doing that again.
Oh, God. Well, if you've only gotten two nicknames in your career, I guess you're doing okay, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I got to ask, what's it like working alongside Bruce Willis as one of his doubles for some of the movies that he's come out with? Are you allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, to a degree.
Okay.
It's like all the actors that are doubled, they're all very different. Bruce is definitely like old Hollywood movie star. He's bigger than life. He's has good days and he has bad days, but he's an icon. You know, he's definitely a huge celebrity, and you see that, you know, when you're with him and you see the way people react when they spot him or what have you. Other actors are just, you know, a lot more down to earth and kind of like normal people. And like I mentioned, Bryan Cranston, he is just, I just love him. He is just a regular guy. I mean, just a talented, super talented, regular guy. But, you know, I know when I first started doubling Bruce, I remember the first time he pulled a chair up next to me and just started shooting the breeze with me. And I'm like, you know, this is pretty darn cool. I got to admit, this is pretty darn cool.
Yeah. He's an American icon action hero in the movie. So his name sort of stands alone. And you have a resemblance to him. I mean, a lot of people will make that comment that you guys – you know, kind of have that same energy draw, you know, that intensity. So it's great to hear that you get to shadow him, you know, in his films.
Yeah.
Are his stunts that hard? Because he's kind of crazy.
Typically, what I've experienced is when we go into like a big movie, he's real gung-ho in the beginning and wants to do as much as he can. But, you know, after a couple of bruises and scrapes and everything, he decides, you know, I should probably, other guys do what they're here for, and I'll stick to what I'm here for. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So your latest project that you're working on, does that keep you in the state, or do you have to travel for that? Because you do have to do a lot of travel, don't you?
Yeah, it's the whole industry has changed. It used to be all Hollywood, and in Los Angeles anymore is mostly TV shows, and there's very few feature films being shot there, mainly because there's a lot of tax incentives in other states that make it pretty attractive for the producers to shoot their movies elsewhere. So more often than not, I'm on location somewhere in another country or another state when it comes to the feature films.
Oh, that's so cool. That's great. My company has an offshoot company in Europe where we'll do water safety for some of the feature films that are being done from the personal watercraft platform. And I know there's several companies around the world that are doing that. But, you know, the stunt aspect with our guys working in there, you know, the coordination, the planning, the detailing, you know, it's all life sustaining. It's all meant to be there for, you know, a genuine purpose of risk. So, you know, what you're doing is not just having fun. It's serious work.
Oh yeah. That's the biggest surprise to people that I have visit on set sometimes is they can't believe how much planning goes into this, where you see it on screen. It just looks like people just going for it and getting crazy. And there is so much put into making sure, doing everything we can to make sure that nobody gets hurt, and then running the different scenarios on what could go wrong, and then what's our plan if that does happen, and having people like yourself there to, if we're dealing with water, to have those outs if something does go bad, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really technical and time-consuming because, like, you'll have a block on the film of maybe a 5-second or 10 or 15-second shot, but the hours and days backing and leading up into that, you know, people can't grasp that, really, or the amount of equipment involved. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the unseen imprint that doesn't translate through, because it's really an art form to itself in a lot of ways. And the players involved are very skilled individuals. And like, you know, you say, I mean, you can lose your life, and stuntmen do lose their life in stunts. Occasionally, it's rare, but it happens because the risk is extreme. You're doing something unordinary, you know.
Right.
You're running around as a ball of fire, you know. It's like, no, you're not going to be doing that, you know. So, hats off to you, Larry, and the men that you work with and the women that you work with, and also to your wife, you know, because the loved ones at home, too, are a big part of that as well. So, you know, they're like the, they have, you know, they have to have that second support for you to go out there also. So, you know, hats off to your wife and your family for supporting the work and all stunt people, because it's a rough life. It's not an easy life. It's fun.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Right. It is. It is fun. But there is that other side of it. I think last year we lost a really high inordinate amount of stunt people. Some of them, a few of them just due to old age, but we did lose a number on shows, and it's a reminder sometimes when that happens. It's like, yeah, what we do is dangerous from time to time, and, that is part of it, the life we've chosen.
We were working a set of a Transformer movie where one of the stunt men was killed. So, yeah, definitely things go wrong quickly, and there's no way to rewind and stop that flow, you know?
Yeah. So, we have a saying, too. A lot of the times it's 90% boredom, 10% pure adrenaline. That's basically our life. We often sit around and wait, and then, like, the final shot of the whole day, then they finally do the stunt, you know, and then all of a sudden you got to be completely on and focused and nail it and, you know, get it done in that moment. But like you said, there is a tremendous amount of thought and rehearsal and planning that go in beforehand.
Oh, definitely.
People are, yeah.
Definitely. So what we've been doing, we being a group of people, and you know some of these cats I'm going to describe, Bob Ferris, he is the gentleman that introduced you into the jet ski movement. He's sort of like, we'd call him the chairman of our board. He's one of our committee members. And then Brad Southworth is one, Brenda Burns, and Rusty Sharman, and then myself. And what we've done is we've cultivated over a period of time a lot of personal archive material and solicited it from friends that they knew or that I knew. And we've been chronicling the history of jet skis. And we're focusing on the founding years from like 1972, when the concept was first being put in place by Clayton Jacobson II, and then up until the year 1979. And we made a list of about 250 people from that time frame that we want to reach out to and capture their stories. And then we also are creating a database of everybody's legacy and a profile. But we have what we call the Wake of Fame Awards, and we just finished our voting for the Wake of Fame Awards, and we go through a committee process. So it's done with a lot of heart and soul, and it's a burden for us because we're talking about people like you, you know, what your inclusion was and the meaning of your time invested, because to us there's an essence there. It's history. And we don't want to lose that history. So we have the Wake of Fame Awards, and I just want to let you know that you've been one of the original inductees for 2016. So we're going to be inducting you into our Wake of Fame Awards on March 10th at the International Boating Water Safety Summit in San Diego. So you're the first person that we've let known. Yeah, it's cool for us.
Wow, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm honored.
So you're one of the very first group of the core individuals that what we felt had the biggest, what I would call footprint or impression for the public for the sport of jet skiing. So it's a big honor for us. We went through a pretty in-depth voting period, researching, collecting data, articles. That's the only reason why I know more about you than I should. And so, you know, like, Brenda was just a huge asset for this, and so was Bob. They have archives that are run real deep, and probably things you aren't even aware or lost contact with that will be surfacing again. And so we will be putting that out on our website and on our Facebook page, and we'll be giving you an official thing for it. But it's just a small core group of people who really care. And we do care about what you contributed and what you're doing now for film, which is pretty phenomenal. And we do thank you. I'm going to speak for everybody in our committee and all the listeners as well. We just thank you for never giving up and coming back stronger than ever after that injury. And I don't know where you're going to stop, but it's going to be exciting to see what you do next in the next 10 years. You know, this legacy is just building and growing. And thanks for motivating people like my children. And, you know, I have a clothing company called Liquid Militia with my business partner and my kids. And we have team riders. We have a lot of free ride riders that we sponsor. And, you know, you're kind of an icon for them. So it's a big thing to talk with you tonight. And thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sean. I'm really glad that you guys are doing this and documenting the history, if you will, and bringing back these memories too. I can't wait to listen to the more episodes and to see what you guys all put together. Because there's just, as we talk about it, I can't keep a smile off my face thinking about the times and the friends and just everything about the whole growth of the sport back then.
Well, maybe in the future when you have some time, we could do a roundtable with a couple of, maybe get Brian Bendix and Silverstein on and do a three-way roundtable with you guys.
Yeah.
It might be kind of fun because we want to do several podcasts a week and try and just build an extensive library. And people can download these to their iTunes or the MP3 player. So this is going to be on the internet forever, as long as there's internet. So long after you and I are dead, you know, children, grandchildren will be, you know, going, oh, my God, listen to those two crazy people. And, wow, Grandpa was way cooler than I thought, you know. So
right, yeah.
That's one of the things we're trying to capture with doing these podcasts. So hopefully we can get you on another one or have you host one with somebody else. And if there's somebody you would like to tag for a podcast, if there's anybody that comes to mind, throw their name out and we'll go search them down.
Okay, yeah, that's great. I'm sure as time goes by, I'll have lots of ideas and lots of names.
Yeah, think of another victim for us that we can capture and hold hostage for an hour and a half.
Right.
But thank you so much, Larry, and best of luck to you and your wife and to your fellow stunt men and women on your projects. We wish you nothing but the greatest of success.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Right on. We'll catch up with you soon. Thanks a lot.
All right.
And good night, everybody.
All right. Take care.
Good night.
Night.
And that's the end of this episode. Thanks a lot, Larry, for chiming in. And go ahead, download this episode, save it, and share it. And we will be seeing you on our next episode. Thank you so much, everybody. Good night.